AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, long ago in another galaxy, there lived a robot. His name was Marvin. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we're going to talk about robots.
We love talking about robots.
We do.
Yeah,
specifically, robot rights.
Well, that's what we're talking about today. Robot rights. The idea of this is something that we see in a lot of science fiction, right? Especially Asimov and that kind of type of science fiction. This idea of developing creatures that have some form of artificial or synthetic intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and therefore have some sort of sense of self. And does that at that point mean that we as human beings should treat these machines as if they were living things and intelligent living things at that?
Right.
Rather than just tools.
Yeah. Usually in science fiction, it's used as a parallel to classism or racism or other issues that's actually talking about humans. But we're working towards this incredible future or kind of incredible present where we might actually have physical robots.
Yeah, it's funny because the metaphor has sort of become a literal question.
Sure.
I mean, there's no question now that all humans should have the same rights.
At least in most civilized human places.
At least we think so.
Yeah.
Right.
But the robots that we've used to illustrate this problem before, now we have to start wondering, like, do they have rights?
Yeah.
In the same way a human does? Nah. That seems, on one hand, it's like kind of easy. It's like, no, they're machines. But I think we should think about this a little more carefully.
Sure. And first of all, I mean, I guess it's good to point out the word robot comes from a Czech word, which essentially means slave.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about robots, that does show that. I mean, when science fiction writers were writing these stories about robots, it really was a kind of a way of talking about human rights and slavery, and not just like, at what point do machines merit rights, but also are rights universal? And United Nations would say yes, there are some universal rights that all humans are, you know, should possess.
But what are they?
Yeah.
So, and how are they applied?
Well, yeah, let's start with the concept of rights and talking about what gets them. So there are material entities that do get rights, for example, humans.
Yeah.
And then there are material entities that we're pretty sure don't get rights, like bananas.
Yeah, no.
Or let's say rocks.
Sure.
Okay.
But in between there, cute puppies.
Yeah.
Where do cute puppies fall on the scale?
Well, I think most people around us would say that the cute puppy has not as many rights as a human, but more rights than a rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a hierarchy.
Okay.
I don't know if you got the memo or not, but I've got the whole list here. Cute puppies are just below cats, and that's only since 1992 when the World Wide Web was introduced.
Okay.
Before that, cute puppies were ruling the roost, but cats have really taken over since the rise of the web.
Okay, well, we've just sort of used our intuitions to say what we think have rights, and that, like, some types of entities have more rights than others. Humans have more than animals. Animals have more than
plants.
Rocks.
Plants have more than rocks.
Yeah, maybe you might
plants,
say that.
Plants might be in there somewhere.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to flesh this out and say, what is the actual rubric we're using? Because if we hone in on that, that might help us decide whether or not an intelligent-seeming robot should have rights. Well, What is it that makes a human have rights?
Well, for one thing, there's this concept of life, right? Just the concept of life itself. And to define life is a little tricky. Even if you go with the scientific definition, it tends to be tricky. For example, one definition here is the condition that distinguishes animals and plants from inorganic matter. Okay, well, all right, we got that. So it's whatever makes organic stuff different from inorganic, that's life. To go further, it says, including the capacity for growth, reproduction, functional activity, and continual change preceding death. Now, there are people who have argued that this is, while a pretty good definition, is still really kind of fuzzy. Because there's some things out there that seem to at least adhere to some of this, but it's hard to define it as being alive. For example, a virus. That's difficult because it has some of these properties, but other things make it seem like it's not really life as we define other types of life. But then there are other things entirely that seem to behave to these rules, but we would never call them alive, like fire.
Hmm.
Fire, does it grow? Yes. If it has fuel, it will continue to grow. Does it reproduce? Yes. It can reproduce. Does it have a functional activity? Well, I guess you could call burning. Continual change preceding death. Yes, that also can be the case. These are things that, you know, if you were to just use that line of reasoning, you might say fire is alive. It seems to behave as if it were alive, but we do not define that as being alive. So just defining whether or not something is alive is already tricky, and we haven't even gotten to robots yet.
Well, but so, you know, and then you get into the psychology or the ethics, the morality of what life is. And that's when you start thinking about, well, is something alive when it has consciousness? Or when it has self-consciousness, and where on the hierarchy do those qualities fall?
Yeah, I'd like to talk a bit about consciousness, because I'm skeptical about life as a definition
it
of
exists.
What has rights.
Oh, no, oh, yeah. I see. I'm sorry, I didn't continue listening to their full thought there.
Well, I mean, obviously, we don't really particularly seem to think bacteria have rights. I mean, that seems...
Yeah, they don't get a lot of voice in the polls.
No.
And so there seems to be a trend that for some reason, like, a dog has more rights than bacteria and humans have more rights than dogs. So maybe it has something to do with the obvious thing that establishes this hierarchy, which is intelligence.
Mm.
Which, again,
is very difficult to define.
Right.
Yeah. But then again, we wouldn't want to create substrate to say, like, if you're a smarter human, you should have more rights than a less intelligent human. Yeah. That's clearly wrong.
Although I do want to see a Star Trek episode about that if one does not already exist.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That makes sense, where the crew visits a planet where people who are smarter have more rights than people who are less smart. I could totally see that.
Okay. So there's a hierarchy established by something having to do with our minds, but it shouldn't just be like how smart you are.
Sure.
So maybe there's a hierarchy based on whether or not you seem to have something called consciousness.
Again, difficult to define.
Difficult to define, but we're going to have to try to deal with it. Okay, so what is consciousness? I think the best way to describe it is the experience of being like something.
Okay.
So there's an experience of being. We know that it exists because we each have it.
Yeah, we have our individual experience of being.
Right. So we know that there's at least one consciousness in the world.
Yes, which may only be ourselves.
Yeah. We assume that all the other humans have consciousness.
Yeah, this is something that Turing was talking about, right? Alan Turing, when he was setting up his thought experiment, the Turing test. So this is a concept where what Joe's talking about is that Joe knows that he possesses this thing called consciousness. Because
there's an experience of being me.
Right. But Joe is the only person who has had that experience. I, Jonathan, have not had the experience of being Joe. So I've had the experience of being Jonathan. I know that Jonathan possesses consciousness because that's me. However, I don't know, as in I cannot know, because I cannot be Joe. I cannot know for certain that Joe possesses consciousness.
And however, some philosophers have said this is straight up impossible.
Right.
You can never experience anything outside of yourself.
Yourself, right. So in that sense, what happens is I make an assumption. I assume that because Joe is a human being and I too am a human being, and that Joe seems to possess the same sort of qualities that I possess, that among those qualities is consciousness, and that Joe in fact possesses it. But I cannot know that for certain.
It also helps that I can tell you I have consciousness.
Sure.
I mean, that's no way to know for sure, but that seems to add to the idea. Like if you... things that attest to be conscious are probably more likely to be conscious.
So, or you're hallucinating, but yeah. That's a separate subject.
Or you're talking to a computer program. This brings us to Turing.
Yeah.
Right.
So what Turing said was that with the Turing test, this idea that you would sit down at a terminal and you would have a conversation, and that conversation might be with another human being who is also on another terminal typing it out to you, or it might be a computer program that's just generating responses. If you are unable to tell the difference reliably, whether that's a human being or a computer program, you might as well say the computer program possesses consciousness. It seems to possess the same qualities you do. And while I would go ahead and say to Joe, Joe, I assume you have consciousness because you appear to do the same things I do, why would I not extend the same courtesy to a piece of software that appears to do the same thing? Again, Turing is saying it doesn't matter really if the program actually is conscious. It just matters that it appears to be conscious because
you can't tell the difference.
Right. Joe appears to be conscious, so I assume that that's one thing he possesses. Lauren appears to be also conscious right now because she had caffeine before we came in here.
But give it a few more minutes of her listening to me.
And, yeah. Well, two of us together are lulling her into a gentle dreamland.
Okay, so this idea of consciousness is relevant to the idea of robot rights because consciousness may very well form the basis of who we decide gets rights. Because I have consciousness, I have things that I want and things that I don't want. So I want freedom, I want safety, I want bodily integrity, I don't want to be worked to death, mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that. And so because I want these things, I assume other humans that, you know, have brains want these things also. And thus, I wouldn't want it done to me. I assume they don't want it done to them.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, humans deserve rights.
Right. You can at least feel sympathy toward other human beings.
If not empathy.
Now, empathy is one of those things that we'll talk about, especially when it gets to robots, because empathy requires sort of a two-way interaction. And so there's certain things that you can feel sympathy toward, but you cannot feel empathy toward because
their experience is intrinsically different than your own.
Or they're not experiencing anything. For example, something that's truly inanimate. You can feel sympathy toward inanimate objects, but not necessarily empathy.
But that's the question, actually. We feel bad about, say, working a human to death. We know that should not be done.
Right.
But we don't feel bad about working a car engine to death.
Right.
Because we assume that the car engine does not actually have an experience of being where it wants to survive and doesn't want to be, you know, worked to death and it wants to have freedom. I mean, that just seems silly to us.
It would be like crushing a piece of ice. Like, you don't feel badly for the ice.
But who knows? Maybe we should, because there are actually a couple of ideas about where consciousness comes from. Do you ever think about what is the cause of consciousness?
Yeah, there's tons of interesting philosophical
thought, right.
There's philosophical debate. Then you have the you have neurologists who take a much more physical approach to consciousness. There's a lot of talk about it.
Well, okay, so you could start on one hand by saying that some people, of course, will probably take like a supernatural view, and they'd say that a soul is responsible for consciousness or something like that. That may be true, but there's no way to show it.
Right. That's not scientific. Yeah, not meaning that it's wrong, but rather that there's no way to test for it.
Right.
Right. So if that's true, we just don't know.
Yeah.
But there are other options of ideas about how consciousness could come about in a physical universe, physically. One idea is this idea of emergentism, which is that consciousness is not present in, say, individual neurons, but only arises as a phenomenon that is somehow more than the sum of the brain's parts. And in this case, it would be basically the idea that the more complex brains become, the higher states of consciousness they achieve.
Interesting.
So that's one idea. It's an emergent property of complex brains, but there are questions that come from that, say like, you have this idea that something's building up towards consciousness. Well, what is it building with? And when you ask that question, you get to a really interesting philosophy, the idea of panpsychism. Have you all heard of this?
No.
I have not.
Panpsychism is the proposal that the universe inherently has mind within it, that all matter, even inanimate objects, may contain units of consciousness. That there is such thing as the experience of being a rock or a pile of sand.
This sounds an awful lot to me like a phenomenon that I was reading about in psychological research called phenomenological intersubjectivity, which basically, I mean, is a unnecessarily long word, that basically means that because humans can only know for certain what it is to be human, that we use this base of experience to evaluate and consider non-human agents.
Yeah, there's a similar thing in literary circles called the pathetic fallacy. Not being pathetic, but rather that you are, in this case, talking about
pithy.
Emotion.
Right.
You're talking about the imbuing emotion upon things that, as far as we know, are incapable of actually feeling emotion. But it's similar, but not the same thing.
Well, but there you're starting with the assumption that this is false. I mean, this is the proposal, is that this may actually be true. And I don't think it's fair to dismiss this idea out of hand. There's actually an interesting philosopher named Galen Strawson. And he's got the idea. He says basically, if you accept that the nature of reality is physical and that consciousness is a feature of the physical world, you should accept the idea that units of consciousness are, in his words, literally physical, like an electric charge.
Well, that might be so, but I would think that that's also possible that it's a manifestation of very specific types of matter. In other words, types of matter like
of
neural
course.
Cells, that would be a manifestation of consciousness. But if you're talking about just, a collection of iron atoms, that might not be. So while you may basis.
It's still an interesting, I can see the argument that the same way that we know that gravitons exist, but that we don't know what they are or what they do, that perhaps there's a conscious neutron that probably wouldn't be called that, but is some kind of quantum unit of ideation.
Yeah, I think the issue with this is I think it's a really interesting idea, and it's because of this same problem, the Turing problem we've talked about, it's just impossible to test.
Which means it's not scientific.
Right.
Again, well, it's philosophy.
It's yeah,
no,
it's,
right. It truly is. But yeah, it's not scientific in
but
the sense
of course,
that you
neither,
can't.
Neither is it scientific to say that rocks don't have mind.
Well, no, unless you are
we
able
can't
to
test against it.
What yeah. you would have yeah. to do is prove that rocks do have mind.
Right.
That would be scientific. It's so.
But you wouldn't be able to do that either.
Well,
I mean,
not using this approach.
Yeah.
so that's the, see, this is one of those things where it's an interesting thought experiment. It's the same problem I have with a lot of philosophy is that ultimately there's not a whole lot you can do practically with this sort
this.
Of idea. Yeah.
Right.
It's just like, well, that's an interesting idea. Moving on.
what you could do is sort of like test it against propositions that are brought up by actual induction, by forms of experimentation and stuff like that, principles that we know to be true in one way or another. Maybe we can test whether or not this idea is consistent with them or not.
Yeah.
Still, it's difficult to tell. But anyway, the point of this is ideas like this, I think, make it not so necessarily obvious that robots don't have an experience of being. As even if you believe in, say, the emergent theory of consciousness, well, I don't know. When you create an intensely complicated neural network through, you know, of a simulated robot brain, are you perhaps creating an emergent phenomenon of experience?
Well, the other argument I would make about this is that even if you were to create some form of consciousness, let's assume that there is a basic unit of consciousness, that everything has some sort of element of this, you cannot then extend the assumption that experience is anything remotely like the human experience.
No, not at all.
So here's the – when you start talking about rights, what we're basing that on is human rights.
You can't even assume that my experience is like yours, though. We're back to the problem we started with, that
no,
you're
but
trapped in your experience.
If we're able to have a conversation, we can at least find ground where we seem to share some form of commonality.
Right.
Right? So now if we're talking about an object that apparently – That may or may not possess this basic element. Again, since you cannot assume that is at all remotely analogous to the human experience, when it comes to talking about rights, it's kind of a moot point anyway, because what we would consider rights for us might not at all be similar to
right.
whatever that conscious thing.
The rock
would
might
rights.
Really enjoy being set on fire,
or
and we just
in,
don't know.
Or turned into glass.
Yeah.
Maybe it thinks it's pretty. So
that's a good point. We don't know. Even if there is such a thing as the experience of being a robot, we can't know for sure what that robot would want.
Yeah.
But like we were just saying, we can't know for sure what anybody else would want.
And we
well,
sure
unless they tell you.
Yeah. Well,
in
which case, that's the good thing about most humans. They will, in fact, very vocally like, tell you.
Right. If you're cutting off someone's foot and they say, I really don't want you to do that, I usually take them for their word. I do it anyway.
Then would we perhaps have some inkling of an obligation to help a robot achieve its task efficiently?
Does the robot want it? I don't know. See, here's the thing is that we first have to get to a point where we have a robot that is capable of what we would consider to be intelligent communication. That in itself does not necessarily mean the robot is intelligent, but it's capable of at least simulating it. And
right.
Turing would say that is enough.
The door that says that it's very pleased to open for you and will be.
Thank you for coming through this door. Yeah. It's
do you have an obligation to help that door open and close as often as possible?
You mostly have an obligation to slowly go mad as the door thanks you for walking through it over and over again, as Douglas Adams had written about extensively. First we get to a point where we have robots that somehow behave beyond simple machines that perform tasks.
Here we're assuming a robot that very closely simulates human intelligence.
Right. Now, once you get to that point, then things really do get tricky. If the robot is able to simulate consciousness and intelligence, whether or not it possesses it is kind of beside the point, because just like Turing was saying, we have to just start assuming that the thing has what it appears to possess, right?
Well, yeah, that's what I sort of meant with the panpsychism thing. We don't know this is true, but on the off chance that it is,
yeah,
should we give them rights?
So that's a good question. And in fact, there was a question asked in a game. It was a game that was associated with the movie AI. So the Kubrick film that ended up being taken over by Spielberg, mm-hmm. It was all about a little boy robot and its adventures and self-discovery.
It's terrible, terrible adventures.
Yeah, so, well, it would have been even more terrible had Kubrick actually directed it. But it, Spielberg has a little bit more of a...
soft space for...
I was going to say schmaltzy, but soft space is good. Anyway, the idea in this game was that you were solving various mysteries. And there were lots of different elements of this game. It was an alternate reality game, an ARG, and which means...
a marketing thing leading up to the film coming out, I believe.
In this case, it was a marketing thing. Not all ARGs are marketing.
Oh, right, certainly.
But this one in particular was. And it actually extended beyond the opening of the film. In fact, people were playing this game well after the film had opened. But the idea was that it was supposed to draw you into the universe created in this particular movie. And you did lots of different stuff. But one of the things that happened was that players in the game were assumed to be in this future world that AI took place in. So you were playing yourself. You were being you, but you were assumed to be in the future. And they actually held a referendum. And in the referendum, they were voting on whether or not robots should receive human rights. Because they had, in the film, if you have not seen it, you see that there are robots that are gaining a sense of self-awareness. Some have more of a sense of self-awareness than others.
Depending on how advanced the individual robot in question is.
Right. So you've essentially reached the point now where robots are capable of experiencing life on some level. Whether or not it's completely analogous to a human is beyond our ability to say, but they are having an experience. That becomes clear in the movie. So the question is, should we extend rights to robots? And they held a vote among the players. I was one of the players who voted no. But the reason I voted no was not because I thought that these rights had to be withheld from a robot force. It was actually more of to start a conversation about how I thought it irresponsible to create such an intelligence in the first place if what you were intending the robot to do was to work for you as a tool of some sort. Like, you should not give a tool these sort of things because the tool has a very specific purpose. Now, I know we like to talk about how all people have a purpose in life. There's a purpose. But in general, we think of that as something that we get to discover for ourselves.
A choice that we get to make.
Yeah, like we get to make choices. We get to choose what we want in an ideal set of circumstances. Obviously, there are people who live in different ones that have very limited, if any, choices. But ideally, you have all the different options open to you, and you make the choices that are right for you, and you find your purpose. However you want to define that. But if you are something that was created for a very specific task, if you're a tool, then really you have your purpose preordained for you. You did not get to make those choices. And so to give something like that intelligence and agency and consciousness to me is incredibly cruel because it means that either you are forcing it to do something that it may not want to do, or that you're just assuming that somehow that's going to make it do the thing that it was supposed to do better. It's not an ideal situation. So that's why I voted against it in the game, knowing that in the game, it didn't ultimately matter one way or the other. The conclusion was going to be that the robots were going to rise up against us anyway. spoiler alert. But it was important to me to have that conversation that, in my mind, it was an unethical approach that unless you had the full intent that we want to create another species, another kind of life, a synthetic kind of life that from the outset, that was our goal, then that's okay. Make sure they have the rights because I think that that's important. If you're giving them that ability to think and to have self-awareness and that's their purpose for whatever reason, give them the rights. They deserve them. But if you are talking about just trying to make a really good toaster, don't give it the intelligence in the first place.
Of course, I guess we have no idea if the toaster has intelligence, but probably not.
I'm going with no. it certainly does have...
not intelligence, consciousness.
Consciousness.
Right. I think it certainly has a sense of vindictiveness based upon how my my toast might come out one day versus another.
Maybe you should be nicer to your toaster.
Maybe I should stop plugging it into that atomic generator I've got in the back. I don't know.
Yeah. One of the follow-ups to the whole panpsychism discussion we had is, of course, like, if that is true, then obviously it would apply to robots, but it would also apply to rocks and toasters.
It would apply to the raw materials of the robot.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing in itself. But I have another thing I'd like to raise, which is that I think whether or not we believe that robots actually do have intrinsic rights, like whether they themselves need and deserve them, we might end up giving them rights anyway for our own needs.
Right. I see exactly what you're saying, Joe. I mean, it may be that it's not it doesn't even necessarily mean that we feel that the robots are truly intelligent or truly conscious. We may even still openly question that and yet give them rights because we tend to identify with stuff. We tend to imbue stuff with characteristics that it may or may not inherently possess. And then if we don't act according to those feelings that we have, we start feeling like that's wrong.
It's AKA anthropomorphism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, in psychology, they talk about it being a way, you know, that humans are emotionally uncomfortable with things that are not like us, and that anthropomorphism allows us to reduce that discomfort.
Yeah, that's attributing human qualities to non-human things, whether it's inanimate or animate. So, for example, like, you know, The Simpsons has this great little moment in one of the early episodes where everyone's looking at, I think it's like a little dog, and the dog sneezes, and one of the characters says, "Ha! Thinks it's people." Well, you know, that's kind of what we're talking about. Anthropomorphism is where, you know, you might look at your pet and just assume that your pet is feeling a certain way, but we really can't know that it's actually having any sort of emotion that's similar to ours. We do think they have emotions, but whether or not they map toward the kind of emotions that we have, that's a huge leap.
Oh, sure. And this theory is not anything new. I mean, this supposedly goes back to ancient Greece where a philosopher was using it to describe the similarity between religious believers and their gods. You know, that he was noticing that the Greeks considered their gods to look basically like them, and that the Africans considered their gods to look basically like them, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. Now in the present, neuroscience research has shown that similar brain regions are involved in thinking about the behavior of humans and also non-human objects.
Yeah, and from what I've read, I think we are particularly susceptible to having feelings about robots. I actually read, this was just published the other day in the IEEE Spectrum.
Sorry, go ahead.
Hey, that's my joke.
So it was a report on a thesis by a University of Washington student, Julie Carpenter, and the thesis was entitled "The Quiet Professional: An Investigation of U.S. Military Explosive Ordnance Disposal Personnel Interactions with Everyday Field Robots." I want to read a little selection from that article.
Says
that what Carpenter found is that troops' relationships with robots continue to evolve as the technology changes. Soldiers told her that attachment to the robots didn't affect their performance, yet acknowledged they felt a range of emotions such as frustration, anger, and even sadness when their field robot was destroyed. That makes Carpenter wonder whether outcomes on the battlefield could potentially be compromised by human-robot attachment or the feeling of self-extension into the robot described by some operators. So there's this perception that there could be a problem, because what you're supposed to use this robot for is to get killed for you.
Right.
Right.
You know, it goes where there would be danger to human life, and to preserve human life, you send your robot in. But the problem is,
if you start feeling bad about the robot dying, then...
Yeah, that's kind of a problem. And I can very much imagine the same kind of reaction happening as we incorporate more robotics into our day-to-day lives. You know, people name their Roombas. They name
them.
Oh,
yeah, of course.
They have
Yeah, they do.
They have feelings about their Roombas, and I highly suspect, I don't have any scientific literature on this, but I highly suspect that people get way sadder when their Roombas break down than when their toaster breaks.
Oh, when and you're it, toaster breaks, it's kind of annoying. I think this has to do partially, and this is, again, I don't have any numbers on it, but I feel like it's probably because robots move autonomously. And autonomous movement is one of those things that we generally apply to living stuff. Mm-hmm. So, for the same reason that that a child might be more upset about a toy that moves around breaking than it would be about a otherwise stationary stuffed animal.
Yeah, it all depends on the emotional attachment. I'm still bitter about my blankie. There was an interesting art project. I was just trying to research and see if I could find. I think it was Mark Owens who did this project. Mark Owens created something called the Avatar Machine. And I wrote an article about it many years ago. Now, that doesn't really apply to this conversation, but I want to say it was Owens that also created an interesting experience. He was really interested. He was, you know, kind of thinking about people's relationships with inanimate objects and technology and how we can form at least a one-way emotional bond with something that itself does not appear to have any kind of emotion or feeling. And I want to say it was Owens who had created this interesting experiment where he had a lamp and had this kind of a membrane stretched over the lamp. So light was showing through the membrane, and then gave people scalpels where they would be able to cut through the membrane to let light show through.
That was their task, right? Their task was to get light to show through.
And the membrane looked like skin. It was very similar to skin, and the idea was that you see how people reacted to the thought of having to cause damage to this thing in order to let light through. And because it looks so much like skin, there were people who were very hesitant to cut it. Like they were afraid of, I guess, of hurting it in a way, or just that the thought of having to cause damage to let light through was something that gave them a sense of hesitation. So that alone, we're talking about just a lamp here. There's no animate part of this other than the fact that the light can come on or
imagine
off.
Imagine it can have convincing conversations with you.
Right. So, yeah, once we get to that part.
And all three of us have talked about off the mic about having problems playing video games when the computerized avatars in the games look too much like a real human person. Like, the more realistic they get, the more uncomfortable we are with causing pain to them.
Right. Yeah.
Even though you know you're not actually hurting any living thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like harvesting the little sisters in Bioshock.
Oh yeah, I couldn't do it. I couldn't. I wanted to see what it looked like when you did it, but I couldn't make myself do it. I had to look it up on YouTube.
Yeah, I didn't do it either. And we had this discussion as well, is that in video games, if you have a game where you are given the choice to do something, whether it's, you know, the moral choice, however you want to define that, or the evil choice, I always go the good guy route. I have trouble playing as a villain, unless it's such a cartoonish villain.
Way to brag.
Well, no, I'm just saying that. I personally can't play that way. Except when it's a game where that's really your, if it's not a choice, if that's just the way the game works, then I end up being able to play through it without too much trouble. But if it's one of those things where you choose one or the other, I hate having to choose things that that don't seem to benefit the people that I like in the game. The people being like the characters in the game that I like.
Mm-hmm. They have no actual experience and you're causing harm to no one.
Right, exactly. Right. I could choose to waste an entire village in an RPG if I had a character who was strong enough to be able to take on all the guards that would immediately be set upon me. But I have problems with it. I like Skyrim's another example. I play Skyrim and I'll walk into an inn, for example. None of those characters are at all alive, but they all have their own little personalities, even though they may be used by the same voice actors that I've heard a billion times in other towns. I can't bring myself to just go into wholesale slaughter mode and start wiping out characters. In fact, I don't know if this happened originally with Skyrim, but recently I've been playing it again, and I would get letters from the first town I went in when a villager would be killed by some other event that happened while I was not in the village, and they had given me an inheritance. They had willed an inheritance to me, and I received gold because they had died. I would be upset about this. I'm like, no, no, poor Osric is dead or whatever, you know. And
yeah, so I think the conclusion of this is that robot rights may be coming whether robots deserve them or not.
Yeah, or need them, or even if they're able to at all think in a way that we consider analogous to human thinking.
Yeah, in my opinion, that would be the rubric for whether or not they actually deserve them. If there is an experience of being a robot, obviously the robot deserves some kind of protection.
Right.
We don't know whether or not there will be, but I think robots will be cute enough and anthropomorphic enough if they're going to be moving around, having conversations with us, mm-hmm. resembling life in any way, even as much as like a bomb disposal robot does.
Right, right. And especially because, you know, there's theories in marketing that tell us that that when we can highly anthropomorphize something, that people will be more likely to buy it.
Yeah.
So this all ties
so,
in.
So, yeah, I very much suspect that we're going to have strong feelings about protecting the interests of our robots, whether or not the robots actually care.
It'll be interesting to see the first case brought against someone for robot abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, that'll really, the way it's decided in the courts will be interesting because it may or may not align with the way that the general population feels.
And it's a good question, too. Okay, so imagine we do grant some kind of rights to robots just voluntarily, say, even though they don't need them. Is it actually immoral to be gratuitously cruel to a robot if the robot can't feel it?
That's a good question. I mean, is there immoral to be just incredibly cruel to play in a video game?
To be evil in Grand Theft Auto? Yeah.
Well, there are certainly non-Western theories. I guess non-mainstream Western theories that say that yes, that causing damage to even non-alive beings is detrimental to your own personal.
So, if I were to draw a picture of a stick figure and then rip it up into tiny little pieces, according to that philosophy, that would be bad.
Well, you know, just the concept of trying to reach freedom from suffering, which is the basic tenet of Buddhism,
sure.
for example, that you know, introducing negativity of any kind into your life is going to negatively affect.
It just reminded me of Hitchcock, who said that he envied Disney because Disney could just
rip up his actors
and throw them away
Hitchcock.
Whenever they were giving him trouble. So
that's great.
Yeah, one of those little nuggets that I just absolutely love. Well, this is, you know, so I agree. I think that robots are probably going to end up, once they reach a certain level of sophistication, end up being given rights by humans, simply because emotionally for us, that's something that will meet our needs, if not the robots. Except for Furbies, because screw those guys. So, yeah, I guess that wraps up our discussion about robot rights. Guys, if you want to join this conversation, you want to tell me, hey, no, Furbies deserve rights too. You're wrong, but you're welcome to try. Go to fwthinking.com. That's where you can find the blogs, the videos, the podcasts, the articles that we write that associate with the different topics we're tackling. Be part of that conversation. Join us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Google+. You can find us with the handle fwthinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.